Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program is proudly brought to you by Culture City, a for-purpose organization that provides a place of acceptance and support for all autism families. For more information, visit culturecity.org.
Hey, 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 I'm Jimmy Carboni from Beer Sessions Radio. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to Cooking Issues. This is Dave Arnold, your host of Cooking Issues, coming to you live on the Heritage Radio Network in Roberta's Pizzeria.
Where's this house? Where is it? Where are we?
Old radio questions.
Where are we?
We're in Chelsea, Manhattan.
Yeah.
That would be incredible.
Bushwick, Brooklyn! So, joined as usual in the studio with Nastasia the Hammer Lopez. How you doing, Stas?
Good.
And she's looking up last week's questions that I missed. And Jackie Molecule's back from his stomach virus.
Yeah.
Was it a virus or were you food poisoned?
See, I was just talking to Stas about this before the show. Everybody pukes and they immediately assume they've been food poisoned,
yeah.
Which is what I assumed when my girlfriend was puking all Valentine's Day weekend. Either that or she was just like sick of me and it was, you know.
Wait, you were both puking it up?
No, so she was first all weekend and then 2 days later I got hit with the same thing in the middle of the night.
That's
so.
Virus. That's not food poisoning unless she got it, cooked you something, didn't wash her hands.
No.
Hit you with it.
No, then she went back to work at a school she teaches at, and like half of the teachers had been calling out sick with the same thing. So
I hope she kept her mouth shut that it was her that did it.
No, it wasn't her. It was some kid in the cafeteria puked when she was working. So, Of course it was a kid. Come on.
Yeah, well, you know, they're a little virus.
But how do you tell, Dave, that if it's, you know, food poisoning or viral? I feel like everybody kind of jumps to that conclusion, right? They're like, oh, it must have been that sushi I had or something.
Yeah, I mean, usually, like, I only know it's food poisoning when... First of all, I very rarely have any of that kind of stuff happen to me. But, like, usually someone else will get hit... Like, because I can survive foods that, like, I've had my wife get knocked out by foods, like puking, like, on the ground, unconscious. I've had, like, friends and family, like, get totally wiped out, and, like, I just feel, like, a little bit not good. But when I get knocked out, and then, like, everyone around me who was eating with me gets knocked out, you're pretty sure it was food poisoning. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah.
At the same time. Also, like, if you eat something that's just intensely stupid and you get hit, pretty much, hey, you know it was the food. Like, my wife once... She went. Are you familiar with?
I thought you're not supposed to tell the story.
Fine, fair.
Yeah. Oh,
all right. Never mind.
Wait. What's intensely stupid food?
Don't buy the week and a half old pre-made parfait at your local, like, you know, supermarket that was made by someone in the back.
Got it.
Don't buy the sushi that's been sitting there all day. God knows how long. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
Don't buy sushi at a supermarket. You know what I mean? That has like raw products in it, because all it takes is one knucklehead to not wash their hands before they do it, or to get some cross contamination, and you are hosed. You know what I mean? And it's not like at least at a restaurant, right? You know, you assume that the people who are cooking have had some sort of training, or there's some sort of cook there who knows what's right and what's wrong, and is going to at least partially prevent. You know, the people making the food from completely destroying the clientele. But, you know, at a supermarket, who the hell knows? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Supermarket sushi, right up there with gas station sushi. You know, our good friend of the show, Peter Kim, once purchased a moldy sandwich made at a gas station and ate it and didn't die.
No, he took the mold off. And then when he was finished with the sandwich, he saw an extra piece of something in the container. And he was like, oh, I'm not done. And then he ate the mold, forgetting that he had taken the mold off.
No, he didn't.
Yeah, now listen.
Ask Peter Kim.
The thing about Peter Kim, lived like literally lived like in a hut in the jungle for years. Can eat. It has amazing pictures from Cameroon of like he was like teaching these little kids, and they would draw pictures of people with like horrible intestinal diseases, like spraying fluids out of every orifice. Intense stuff. So I guess he is a strong personality in terms of his constitution. So you know he's like, what's mold going to do to me? Although I'll tell you what. the problem with mold is you never know what kind of mold. If you're worried about what kind of mold you got, bad mold has the aflatoxin, and then you don't know until you get the cancer, like 20 years later. You know what I mean? You know what I'm saying? I'd stay away from it.
Well, we'll check in with Peter in 20 years, right?
Wow. For a number of reasons.
Wow, that's rough.
There's a caller on the line.
Okay, caller, you're on the air.
Hi, Dave. This is Andrew from Pittsburgh.
How you doing?
I'm doing well. I'm a bartender, and I just had a bunch of really fantastic USBG classes yesterday.
Nice.
One of them was a vermouth class, and the guy giving the class talked about orris roots and its role in gin, and he kind of described it as, he said it kind of helped lift all the other ingredients. It doesn't really have a flavor by itself. It's just kind of bitterness, but it helps lift all the other flavors.
Well, it's got a flavor. It's got like a kind of also like a vague kind of sweetness. I like orris. I think orris is good. You know what I mean? We were playing with orris last week.
Yeah, so I think it's good.
Yeah, I mean, you don't want I don't know that anyone's ever made a plain orris root liqueur. I don't think it would stand on its own, but you know what I mean? It's right. It's good. Anyway, so what do we got going with orris?
Okay, so I mean, that anything that was adds an additive effect to a lot of other ingredients always interests me. And so, I looked up, tried to find as much as I could about it, all the usual suspects. I went to McGee, and he didn't have anything. And then I went to Amy Stewart, and she just had a very short little piece on it, talking about how it was, like, a fixative and how old fragrances or flavors in solution, like creating some sort of missing compound to keep them from volatilizing.
Is that true, or is that just a theory?
I have no idea on this. So, I mean, I'm coming at it from hearing about this less than 24 hours ago.
Right.
So,
I don't understand why it would do that.
Yeah. That's kind of my question was, if you knew more about it and what you could do with it, or if it was possible to make a tincture that would that you could use to kind of act as a way to lift a bunch of other ingredients, if that's even possible. Or
well, obviously certain flavors and also certain aromas and certain tastings, right, can push and pull other flavors up and down in the way that you perceive them, even if they themselves are not immediately perceivable. And so the obvious ones are, of course, vanilla and salt, right? So, it's entirely possible, feasible that orris also has some of those characteristics. I don't understand what would be in orris root that would literally fix, in other words, make volatiles less fugitive. You know what I mean? I mean, maybe. I don't know. Maybe the thing is I've carbonated things with orris before, and I don't notice it doesn't have any, like, it doesn't really change the viscosity. It doesn't, like, doesn't appreciably, I don't think, change the surface tension too much. So I don't know what – or in other words, I don't see anything that it would change that would stop stuff from volatilizing. But it might make volatiles more apparent to you. Now, what typically, like Nastasia and I literally, we did this like a week ago or 2 weeks ago. What you should do is – and I'm sure you have a local – store in Pittsburgh. You know, we have a couple here, and I know, you know, a couple where they are in Philadelphia, but you know, everyone's got one, or there's the internet, and you know, just get a bunch of different things, and I would make a water-based tea, and then I would do an alcohol tincture, and I would do one like hot, it depends on how much experimentation you want to do, hot, cold, and then ISI, and then you can kind of get a range, because what happens is that the different extraction techniques, i.e. in water or in oil, water or in alcohol, will pull out different different properties. And also, whether it's hot or cold or whether it's ISI is going to change the extraction speed. And usually the faster extraction speeds tend to reduce bitter components and increase kind of aromatic highlights, which is nice. And so what you do is you just make a whole boatload of these tinctures, make them one item, right? And then you can go about and mix them. So if you're very accurate, if you measure exactly how much product you put into your tinctures, I'm doing 20 grams of orris into 500 mils of water, 500 mils of boiling water, steeping it for 5 minutes and straining it. Bang. Now you know, and you know, you keep track to make sure that the orris root's always the same size all the time, so your extraction rate's the same, et cetera, et cetera. Then, you know, you're like, okay, I put 5 milliliters of that solution in, and then, 20 20 milliliters of mace, the solution, and blah, blah, blah. And then you can go back and reconstruct your recipe. Now, it's never going to taste the same when you try to do all your extractions at the same time or you average them out, but you can get pretty close and you can really kind of fine-tune your mixtures. Or, for instance, you could buy someone's gin and you could jack the orris. You know what I mean? You can do a bunch of things like that. So it's a lot of fun. But, you know, in order to do experimenting, you really have to – and it's a, Stas, how much of a pain in the ass is it? Pain in the butt. Yeah, family show. But the – yeah, so you're sitting there with, like, you know, 30-quart containers all labeled and, you know, don't even bother tasting at the get-go. Just crank quart containers out with different known solutions in them and then just go out tasting. Teas are the fastest, right? I mean, like, and cheapest, because you're not blasting through alcohol. So I think as a first approximation, alcohol is going to taste entirely different. But, you know, just for fun playing around, it's really fun doing teas. And then the great thing about teas is that you can use them for sodas. You know what I mean? So you can make sodas and non-alcoholic stuff. And then you can later kind of re-ramp those recipes for alcohol or bar. But the remembering that if you do extractions in alcohol, you almost invariably pull more bitter components out.
Okay. And was that using fresh orris, or was that using the really over-dried orris that they do to get the iron to, like, they something oxidized and turns into iron?
The only stuff I've ever used is like dried. It's like they almost look like very white wood chips, but they're small.
Got it.
Yeah, that's the only kind I've ever used. You've seen it fresh, or?
No, I haven't. I was just curious if there was a way to use it fresh, because the only one that I've seen and talked about was super, super dried.
Yeah.
So it oxidizes a lot, so it can produce the iron.
I mean, that's like the characteristic one I'm used to is that. And remember is that, you know, most of the time when people were making liqueurs and things like that, they were dealing with the dried article anyway. Because,
right.
You know, they weren't growing it necessarily. And if they were stockpiling it and drying it. Dry stuff is a lot more stable. So, you know,
right.
You would never make, and there's a question later we're going to talk about, hopefully, that you never would make something that is intended to be stable with something unstable. Right. And
right.
So liquors and liqueurs and spirits and whatnot typically are meant to be relatively stable over a relatively long period of time. So in general, you'd be using things that are dried out. Now, I do the exact opposite a lot and try to make things that you wouldn't ordinarily have fresh that couldn't be made as a commercial product because they won't last. And that is really fun to do, right? So like fresh turmeric, for instance, or fresh galangal, or you know, things like this that the where the freshness couldn't be really made into a commercial product. But you can because you're going to sell it right away. But the problem then is if you don't sell it right away, you're stuck with a lot of product that costs money. But, you know, that's life in New York City.
Yeah. Right. All right, great. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Hey, no problem. Good luck. Wait, so what were we talking about, Saz?
Food poisoning.
Oh, yeah. So, yeah, just stay away from the supermarket sushi. Right, Saz? Do you ever eat that stuff?
No.
What is there anything that is, like, really, like, stupid like that you like to eat?
Mark eats the tiramisu from Food Emporium.
Whoa, not anymore. Food Emporium out of business, remember?
Or Fine Fare, every night.
Whoa. Mark Ladner,
night.
Chef of Del Posto Restaurant, eats the tiramisu from the Fine Fare. You don't even have Fine Fare. Wait, people, for those of you that know, they shop at Big Apple Supermarket, which is Big Apple Supermarket. At least the roaches are refrigerated.
I haven't shopped there in a while.
Yeah,
mm-mm.
I used to like shopping there because they have the giant buckets of food, like the giant thing of cheese, the government cheese blocks, and the giant cans. I forget what can I used to buy. There's some giant can of food, number 15 that I used to buy there all the time for home. I loved it. You hate it?
It's just a little further.
Yeah. Okay. So, Stas, another question, maybe of interest. Did I see that our patent, provisional patent, got put in or
yeah.
No? So we can talk about it now?
I guess so.
You sure?
I can recheck.
Yeah, she's going to recheck, and if we're allowed to talk about our new patent, we can. Oh, and did we have we have a new product? It's not like a big new product. Don't get excited. But we're going through beta testing now with some users. We heard anything back? Do people like it? Do they hate it?
Yeah, Nick likes it.
Really?
He's trying to find how to use it with Pebble Ice.
Huh. So how long until we start selling it, you think?
I don't know, like 2 weeks.
Okay, so for those of you that were listening, I don't know, we've talked about it before on the show, right? There's this, okay, listen, when you're shaking a cocktail, you want to shake with big ice, right? Why? Because the texture is better. That's it. The texture is just better. But a lot of times you don't have big ice, right? When I say big ice, I'm talking like 2 inches on a side big ice. And something about that big cube rattling around inside of your shaker makes the texture better. But the problem is that you don't have that ice a lot. And even if you do have that ice, it's shake once and you throw it away. So you're throwing away all this ice. So your freezer is going to be full of these big ice cubes. You shake them once, you throw them away. It's wasteful, right, Stas?
Right.
Waste. And also, if you're doing an event, right, and this is why we came up with it. If you're going to do an event and you're going out to, let's say you're going to some, like, crap tank, you know, cater location. I'm not saying that all cater locations are crap tank. Many are beautiful, but you know what I'm saying, Stas, crap tank. Mm-hmm. So you go there and the ice they bring you is like the world's worst ice. It's like it like literally is like a soupy mess of like tiny shells and broken things. You know what I'm talking about, Stas.
Mm-hmm.
So that ice, from a dilution standpoint, as we all know from the fundamental law of cocktails, if anyone's read the Liquid Intelligence, like the dilution is going to be fine as long as you shake off the excess water that's on it because it's got a lot of surface area water on it. But the texture is not going to be good. So what you do is we made this fake cube. What do we call it? The cocktail cube?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Doesn't chill drinks. Listen to me, please, very freaking carefully. It does not chill drinks.
Wait, do I freeze this cube?
Oh, my God. You're going to confuse the people, Stas. Seriously.
It's not going to actually register in their brains until you say it 3 times.
Okay, listen. Dude, listen. People are like, okay, so you put this in the freezer and you use it instead of ice cube. No. 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 First of all, you need ice to melt to dilute the drink or the dilution will be wrong, right? I mean, clearly you need ice to melt. And plus, we make this cube out of a polymer. It's polyurethane that is an insulator. It does not chill, nor does it heat your drink. Does it chill it, Stas?
No.
Does it heat it?
No.
Should you put it in your freezer?
No.
Right. It neither chills nor heats. It's just there to provide texture. So you throw this into your shaker along with whatever crap tanking ice you have at your event or at your wonderful house, and you shake it, and then you wash off the cube and you start again. Now, the one thing I have been told is that you should run, and it's not in the instructions, people, but that you should run this polyurethane cube through the dishwasher once before you use it to, you know, because it's and we should have put it in the instructions, but it's a manufactured item, so you want to wash it before you use it.
Yeah, I'd say dishwasher, right?
Yeah, it's like a rubbery polyurethane because we discovered that if we used a really hard one that it would like kind of like make little flakes. But it's rubber, works great, but it's not so rubbery. Did I talk about this in the show ever?
Yeah,
we made one so rubbery that it felt gross. Oh, speaking of, are we allowed to talk about your sister's art piece? Is that your sister's art piece?
Not hers.
No? All right, so we won't talk about it. But speaking of, like, rubbery things that may or may not feel like they belong in an adult shop.
Oh,
like,
God.
Yeah. This art piece that Stas sent me a gif of is unreal. I wish we could talk about it because it reminds me of an art piece that I did. And
she doesn't know. Somebody made it there. I don't know.
Oh, it's not hers?
No, unfortunately.
Yeah. No.
I'll talk about it to you, Jack.
Okay. So
I put a caller on the line.
Caller, you're on the air.
Hi. Hi, Dave, Nastasia, and the whole gang. I'm a huge fan of the show. I've been trying to make some veggie chips. Okay. So far, I've been experimenting with taro, sweet potato, rutabaga, and cassava. I've been having a hard time getting the sweet potato and rutabaga to crisp up nicely. I was wondering if you had any suggestions.
Right, so they're soft and they go brown too fast, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Are you soaking them a lot beforehand?
So I tried two different things. One of them, I rinsed them off in like cold water, and then one other time I salted them for a half hour beforehand. And both things didn't really work.
Yeah. So there are a couple issues here. Wait, what was the sweet potato? What was the other one you were having problems with?
I'm sorry?
The sweet potato you were having problems with, what was the other one?
Rutabaga.
Rutabaga. Huh. Does rutabaga have... I guess rutabaga does have sugar in it, huh?
Yeah, it was pretty sweet when I like tasted it raw.
Yeah. I love rutabaga. I've never had a rutabaga chip. I love it. I don't know why... Do you know why that the Brits call it Swede?
No.
Me neither. It's a delicious vegetable. Don't you find it an underused vegetable?
Yeah, I mean, it tastes kind of like turnip to me.
Yeah, but better. In other words, like, if someone said to me, hey, you could have a rutabaga, or hey, you could have a turnip, would you ever say, give me the turnip?
Never. Rutabaga sounds so much better.
Doesn't it, though? What do you think, Jack?
It's obvious. Yeah. I mean, yeah, obviously.
Rutabaga. So, here's the thing. Sugar is doing two things bad to you. One, it's browning very quickly when it's frying, right? And secondly, as it cools down, the residual sugar, because it's hygroscopic, is going to be absorbing moisture and is going to make them soft and pliable, which are both your enemy. Which is why, by the way, sweet potato fries in general, fries, not chips, fries, hard to make taste good, and so I never order them ever. So how do you get around this? One, if you soak to try and get as much soluble sugar out as possible, you're going to win somewhat. The other thing you're going to want to do is that you're going to want to get as much of the liquid out of the thing before it goes brown. So are you starting with cold oil?
Cold oil, I haven't been.
You should. With chips, okay. Here's the thing, right? So the common wisdom when you're frying something, right, is you put the oil in and you put it in hot and you don't let the temperature drop too much because, God forbid, if the temperature drops, the oil is going to get absorbed into whatever you're frying, right? This is what we've all been taught growing up, right?
Yep.
Okay. In a chip, chips are supposed to be filled with oil. Anyone who tells you that a chip is supposed to be freaking saturated with oil, like half the weight of a chip is the oil that's been absorbed. It's solely crust. There is no reason to not fully inundate a chip with oil. Now, you don't want grease on the outside, right? You want to put them on a towel and get the excess grease. Greasy chips, disgusting. But having oil in the chip itself, not bad. In fact, necessary. That's what a chip is. That's why those quote unquote baked chips are an abomination, enemy of quality, ridiculous freaking things that should be banned. They should not call them. They should call them something else. Do you like those things, Stas?
No.
Jack, do you like those dang things?
No, no, no.
They're ridiculous. Well, like, the thing is they're a joke. Why don't they just call them something else? Do you know what I'm saying? They're not a potato chip. Okay, enough. But listen, if you start from a cold oil, what happens is that you can regulate the heat. You need to get rid of all of the water. That is your problem. You need to get the water out of those chips before they turn brown. So if you go cold, then you can do that. So, for instance, some people do this by putting a vacuum on. So there was people used to try to sell this thing called a GastroVac, which was it didn't really work, but they said it was a vacuum fryer. But the problem is that they put a vacuum pump on it that didn't have the cojones to really suck a vacuum while you were frying, right? It didn't work. But people commercially use a vacuum fryer to make things like apple chips. So the apple chips, they want to fry them, but they don't want to absorb a lot of oil because they're – I don't know why, because they're low-quality people. And they suck a vacuum on it so that they can get rid of the water at a low temperature without the apple browning because the apple's got a lot of sugar in it, right? And so if you had a commercial system, which is I think how they do a lot of these kind of things commercially, you could suck a vacuum while you fry, but that's not really an option for you. For you, I would say do an initial soak to get rid of as much of the sugar as you can, then start from cold oil and bring it up slow, get the water out, and then at the last minute let the temperature ramp up to do any additional browning that you want after they've kind of bubbled the stuff out. You ever fry tortillas?
Me? No, I haven't.
You should. Because
yeah, I have.
Yeah, because if you buy – first of all, like buying tortilla chips, they charge too much for the tortilla chips, and I find them too thin. I don't enjoy the thin – do you enjoy thin tortilla chips?
No, I do not.
I do not enjoy them.
They suck.
You want the thick ones. So like I'm not a fan of the maseca in general if you can get the real masa, but like for frying, they're fine. Just go buy like the regular like big stacks of tortillas. I break them in half like a book, like book, not break them, but like fold them so that they separate, and then like peel them all individually apart, put them down into a stack, chop them into six, and fry them. But they're good practice for chips, for potato chips, because they're a lot more forgiving than a potato chip. But you just want to look at a tortilla chip, right? And it's going to bubble like a lunatic for a while, stir them up, and then you're going to notice the bubbling start to subside, right? And that's when you know that you've gotten almost all the water out of the tortilla chip. Now, the mistake people make when they fry tortilla chips is they pull them out too soon because they don't want them to get too dark. But when you pull them out, you have that little circle on the inside of the triangle that's too white. Anyone know what I'm talking about, Stas? You know what I'm talking about?
I know what you're talking about.
And then you tap it, and it's not crunchy.
Yeah.
And that's the worst. No one wants a soggy, unless you're making chilaquiles or something, nobody wants a soggy tortilla chip. It's not what you want. And the same goes true for potato chips. But I would practice maybe with tortillas on the frying, because you can start tortilla chips also from cold. You don't need to, and bring them up. And you'll notice that the water, if you get the oil temperature right, the water will go away. And then you have like a couple, like you have several seconds of window between that and when they start over-browning. I also don't like an over-browned tortilla chip. Do you like that stuff?
No,
they start getting that burned, over-nutty flavor.
Yeah, good.
Tortilla chips, good practice for you, and very cheap. And everybody likes tortilla chips that have been fried at home. They're just so much better. They really are. Right, Jack?
I agree.
All right. Give that a try and tweet us back and let us know how it worked.
Will do. Thank you very much.
All right, no problem. Hey, Jack, should we take a break?
That's what I was just going to say.
All right, buddy.
Today's program is proudly brought to you by Culture City, a for-purpose organization that provides a place of acceptance and support for all autism families. This is Culture City's founder, Julian Maha.
Culture City was really born out of necessity. You know, it was born when my, currently six-year-old boy was diagnosed with autism. His name is Abram and he's nonverbal. And even though my wife and I were both physicians at the time, it was really hard for us to find any resources at that point to help him. All the other organizations out there that we know of, they do phenomenal work, but their main focus is basically finding a cure for autism. Our main focus is basically trying to prepare the community to accept not only children with autism, but their families as well. You know, in addition to that, we also want to provide help to these families in the here and now. You know, so tangible things like, you know, iPads for nonverbal kids, you know, financial scholarships, therapy scholarships, you know, art camps, and also some lecture series that can teach parents about, you know, dietary issues, you know, how to financially plan and things like that.
For more information, visit culturecity.org.
Sounds good. Are they good people, Jack?
Oops, sorry. They are very good people. Yeah, in Birmingham. Very, very good people.
Yeah. You know, that's exactly right, I think. The attitude is like everyone, you know, focuses on a cure when you get hit with a diagnosis for your kids like that. It's like, oh, cure, cure, cure. But no, it's like what you want to do is have your kid be the best them they can be, have the most joy in life for what they want. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. Yeah, that's what they do. That's the whole point of the organization. And they're great. And they also kind of like they were a big part of the wave of getting like iPads and noise canceling headphones in restaurants and stuff. So, you know, like having things available for kids with autism and families that want to dine out or go out. They do tons of work. Culture City with a K. Definitely check them out.
Yeah, and you know, that's the other thing. If you see, like, look, parent, like people who don't like haven't dealt with these kinds of issues, just be charitable to people around you. If you're like, why is a kid doing that? Just shut up and leave him alone. You know what I'm saying, Jack?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Because there's a lot of things that you don't understand, like why this kid can't eat food that are mixtures. And look, I have problems with it too. Like, why can't kids? Why? Who knows? But, you know, deal with it. That's life. It is a weird thing not liking foods mixed together, right, Stas?
Mm-hmm.
Were you like that when you were a kid?
Yeah.
Not like, you know, like.
Not Rose or whatever.
Yeah, like Booker can't have anything mixed. Like, he wants his chicken broth by itself.
Remember when you gave him a chicken breast and an egg, and I said that's a bad idea because...
I think you prompted him.
No, I didn't. I said it to you privately.
He's like, Dad, too much protein, Dad.
No, too much chicken.
Not too much chicken protein because there's an egg.
The egg and the chicken, and he's the same animal. Dinner.
Hey,
here's your dinner, kid.
Here's your dinner. Well, look, at the time, he just wanted, like, all he wanted was chicken and egg. So I figured I'll combine two things he likes separately on the plate. I don't know. Whatever. So, Stas, do me a favor. I had a question. I didn't get a chance to look up the recipe because I don't have it committed to memory. I've had it committed to memory before, but I erase it from my mind. Can you look up a Long Island iced tea? Because we had a question about it, and you can ask me. Meanwhile, I'll hit another question here. This in from Benjamin Terry.
My sister wants you to know that is not her art project.
Okay. There may or may not be
don't call
a rubber. There may or may not be a rubber male member attached to a servo motor that goes back and forth like a windshield wiper, and as it's moving out of the way, a steak knife comes down and just misses it. Right?
Yes.
And so that's the piece that Nastasia's sister said she didn't make. But it reminds me very much of a piece that I actually made back, before I went to grad school. Did I tell you about this piece?
Maybe.
I don't think I've told this on the air. It's stupid. But it involves with knives. It's one of the worst cuts I've ever received in my life. I've received some pretty bad cuts. So I was very interested in my artwork in machines and kind of false, like, spectacle where it looked like you were going to get hurt, but you weren't, or like there was danger, but, you know, you didn't end up hurting yourself. So I built this little – I built this little kind of machine that was supposed to be a tiny, like, amusement park ride, and you grab this handle with your hand, and as you spin the handle, a razor – like, I built this knife with razor blades all on it, like all real razor blades, and as your knuckle went down, the razor blade would accelerate over the top of your knuckle. So you couldn't – like, it was geared, so you couldn't cut your hand, but it accelerated so fast around over your hand that it was like, boom. Like, boom, blinding right over your knuckles. Like, and so I would sit there and I would crank it with all these gears, and it would just be boop, 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 these razors right over your hand. It's kind of like freaky, right? So that was the whole thing, this like kind of little mini amusement park ride. So anywho, I'm going to – I applied to – actually went to – what got in, went to Columbia University for Fine Arts as my MFA grad school. So I'm like, you know, I'll bring an art piece with me so as I can show them what I do in the interview. And so I'm having this interview with Alan Hacklin, who is he's an artist, and he's the head of the program at the time. And so I'm talking to him, and you know how it's hard for me sometimes like to talk and do stuff at the same time?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I'm talking to him, and I had to disassemble it to take it with me, right? So I'm assembling this thing while I'm talking to him, and like pieces everywhere. And because I'm not paying attention, I assemble it, get ready for it, Jack, 180 degrees wrong.
Oh boy.
And so what that means is that the – that my knuckle is in the high position when the blade is over your hand. And so I'm like, and so you can never cut your shaboof. And it, like, the razor blade embeds itself like all the way into my knuckle. I still have the scar, and blood just starts pouring out of my hand all over his desk in the middle
like,
of the interview.
Urine.
Well, and I kept on, like, maybe because like my reaction was, I like pulled like a napkin off of his desk and wrapped it around my knuckle and tried to like keep as much pressure on as possible, blood like seeping out of it all over my lap. Yeah, they let me in. I could finish the interview, kind of scraped the thing under my one arm and like kind of walked out. Anyway.
Wow.
Yeah. So.
Okay. Long Island iced tea.
Let's see what you got, Stas. I got one too.
What's in the – okay. Give
me 2 cups ice cubes, 1 ounce vodka, 1 ounce gin, 1 ounce white rum, 1 ounce white tequila, 1/2 ounce triple sec, 2 tablespoons freshly squeezed lemon juice, 1/2 cup cola, 2 lemon wedges.
Ooh. What do you got, Jack?
This recipe says sour mix, but I mean that's, you know. Then there's the Wondrich variation.
What's his?
So Wondrich has 1/2 ounce absolute vodka, 1/2 ounce Beefeater gin, 1/2 ounce Don Q white rum, 1/2 ounce Milagro Blanco tequila, 1/2 ounce fresh lemon juice, simple syrup, and wow, you know, this is.
I wonder if Pernod Ricard paid for that recipe. Those are all Pernod products.
I have to ask you something though. I've never been able to pronounce Cointreau. It's Cointreau, right?
Cointreau.
Yeah. Okay. Good. Yeah.
Quanch. The Quanch. I love that stuff. You like Cointreau?
I have trouble with Curacao.
And Coke.
You have trouble with pronouncing Curacao?
Not anymore.
I pronounce everything wrong. I got in a huge argument with my wife just a couple days ago because I was like, we talked about it on the air. Last week we talked about it. I'm going to say coupon. She's like, that's not what it is.
Oh, that's a few weeks ago, yeah.
Do you know what she gets really mad at me for? Like, you know the word, like, opaque?
Mm-hmm.
I say it opaque. She's like, it doesn't have 3 freaking syllables. It's opaque. I'm like, no, I say it opaque. And like, I don't care. Like, I'll call it chicken if I want. I'm that character.
Wow.
Like, you know what I mean? It's like, leave me alone. You know what I mean?
Wow.
Yeah. Well, if these are the only problems you have in a marriage, God bless you, right? Okay. The question about Long Island Iced Tea, John from Dallas. And by the way, I tweeted out, you know, I saw J.R. Ewing's hat at the Museum of the Moving Image, which is a fantastic museum. And I did it on Instagram. But he had a really not that expensive hat for J.R. It was like I like shoved my face against the side of the display case so I could look and see inside the hat band. And it was just a triple X beaver, which is like, you know, like an $80 hat, a $70 or $80 hat. I have the same hat, but I've remolded it, of course, into a planter shape because that's the only shape that I wear. Whatever. So John from Dallas asks, what affects the perception of alcohol in Long Island iced tea? The drink is almost completely liquor, yet is famous for tasting nearly non-alcoholic. It doesn't seem like it should work. Well, I haven't had one in a long time, although Tristan back in the day used to – and Robbie used to make these carbonated Long Island iced teas, which they were just doing it for the acronym. But the – why it works, I think it has to do with any time that you mix Stas just getting on board and any time that you mix a boat ton of stuff together, everything tends to even out, you know what I mean, and you kind of just lose the ability to distinguish anything. So I think it's just the cola is probably watering it down and the lemon, and then it's just a poop spray of ingredients. I mean, I think that's the only thing I can think of. I don't think it's a magical list. I think you could rejigger it with almost anything else in it and it'd be fine. I'll tell you what we did once at the bar. I get very I get kind of pretzeled when, you know, the bartenders come up with drinks that have like 35 different ingredients in them. And so and I've said it on the air a million times, I call it like shotgun mixing. So I went to the bar once and I literally just went on the back bar and I took the first 15 liqueurs and I just mixed them all in equal proportions. Just picked them all up, 15 liqueurs, bang. And they're like, yeah, it tastes fine. Tastes like cocktail. Tastes fine. I'm like, duh. Because if you mix a bunch of crap together, it just is kind of like uniform cocktail pablum. You know what I'm saying? And so I think something's happening there. The same thing with the iced tea. Was there anything brown in it?
No.
Yeah, that's it. They're sticking away. They're staying away from the brown. Okay. Benjamin Terry wrote in, I'm trying to figure out a vegan.
Cola.
The cola also cuts. Yeah.
No, brown.
Oh, brown. But not mean liqueur.
I don't know.
Yeah. I'm trying to figure out a vegan replacement for egg whites in a cocktail setting. Lately, I've been playing with aquafaba, the chickpea brine, which we have a lot of people who are interested in the chickpea brine. Stas, I know. Freaking chickpea brine. And while I haven't noticed too much of a flavor or odor variation, it certainly isn't as frothy as an egg white. I'm mostly using the chickpea water from the falafel place across the street, cold soaked. Would heat change the chemistry and make it frothier? I bet it would. Yes, I would definitely. Yeah, 100%. It would also taste more. Any tips for this process or for any other egg white replacements in your experience I should try? Thanks. Well, most of the egg white replacements I've used actually are not vegan. So like milk washing, there are certain ingredients that are inherently frothy. So using those – here's the thing, right? Okay, look. Egg whites are doing two things in a cocktail. They're providing a texture and a foam froth. But also the proteins in the egg whites are binding with flavors in the cocktail and kind of muting them. So like one of the reasons that an egg white is really good in whiskey sour is because it deadens the kind of tannic nature of the wood in the oak. So there's a flavor thing happening there as well. So if you're going to substitute out – now you can just go buy, by the way. I don't know if you're against this. You can go buy frothy. The problem with frothy, which is a cocktail frother, and I think it's – I don't know, remember whether it's propylene glycol alginate or just propylene glycol, but with some emulsifiers, is that they also add flavor to it, like citric acid and like fake lemon flavor. I don't know why the hell you would do that. Like, just sell me the freaking froth. You know what I mean, Stas?
Yeah.
Don't sell me the froth plus some other BS. Just sell me the froth. But I'm sure someone makes one that just has the froth in it. But you know that adds the foam. But I don't think it's gonna do that flavor change thing for you. Now, anytime you are going to put a foam on something, a lot of times what people want to do is they want to add a stabilizer. So like your chickpea thing probably has some stabilizing stuff in it. I have tried various cocktails with xanthan as a stabilizer. It's not a whipping agent. You still need a whipping agent, something like a pineapple juice or a cucumber juice or VersaWhip or anything that has kind of a whipping ability to it. But a little bit of xanthan can stabilize the foam so that it lasts longer. Problem is that, remember we did that test with all those xanthans and you could kind of taste it. It was kind of like a little bit.
Don't remember that.
Yeah. Anyway, so I don't have anything 100%, but try the frothy. I'll try to think about it more. Anyone on the webinots on our chat room there can crank in on it too. Okay, so what should we talk about in the few minutes we have left? Should we talk about the patent? Should we talk about flowers on Fleurage?
I just wanted to double check with him, and he hasn't written me back.
All right, so we'll talk about it next time then. Sure. But we got the patent in, working on the centrifuge hard. It's a long road. Once I can talk about the patent, I'll talk about, because someone asked me what's it like to try to make a product in China, and I can talk about it. Did I say China like Trump? Did I just do it? Did I just use Trump's accent when I said
China?
China. He has a really weird way of saying China, right? China. Very strange. We'll talk about when that gets back. All right. So then, did you have any questions from last week I need to hit, or should I hit this other one?
You had one about, did you talk about the pineapple and the Searsol pineapple drink? Searsol, the guy wanted you to acknowledge.
No.
It's nothing. It's not a question.
Oh, all right. Well,
YouTube videos.
Oh, all right. Well, who was it? When we say go look at their YouTube video of pineapple, I like it. I like that. I like pineapple. I like Searsols. While you're looking for that, I will read this. My wife works as an assistant winemaker and is planning a blind tasting of wines doped, with different floral components to taste through with a group of winemakers where she works. We have done – by the way, we're doing a centrifuge teaching seminar today, right?
You are doing that today.
Yeah. Look, when we talk about the patent, I'll do a little bit about how centrifuges work and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Okay. We have done similar experiments with fruits and herbs, and it is fairly straightforward to extract the characteristics. However, flowers are more of a challenge. There are issues getting all the flowers fresh, extracting floral aromatics versus the green character, among other concerns. Yeah, so people like pick the calyxes off of flowers. Dealing with flowers is a pain in the behind. I don't have the list of flowers at present, but I'm sure it includes jasmine, honeysuckle, violets, roses, etc. Are there specific methods for making extracts or essential oils that are food safe and can be added into wine directly and are stable for weeks to months? This would make finding all of the flowers fresh at the same time less of an issue. If so, what would be the preferred liquid to perform our own extractions that we can later add to wine? Okay, from Bobby. So I would definitely get in touch with Mandy Aftel, the perfumer, because she deals with this kind of stuff all the time. But in general, flower essences, to me, they're not necessarily the same as the actual flower itself. Sometimes they're pretty close, right? Like rose. Yeah. Rose can be pretty close. Mm-hmm. But you don't want to do a straight extraction into – most of the time, if you try to do a straight extraction of a flower directly into alcohol, it gets that disgusting – soaked flour flavor. You know what I'm talking about, Saz? That
yes.
Gross soaked
yeah.
flour flavor.
Yes. Yeah.
So typically the kind of essences are made in one of several ways, but steam distillation is the easiest, kind of the cheapest way to do it. But a lot of flower aromas are, and then they're fixed in alcohol or other things, and you can get them, and they're stable, and you can get them food grade. I mean, some flowers are poisonous, and so you should stay away from them. Remember, we were going to put some poisonous flower into a drink, and I was like, come on, is a little bit okay? And they're like, no, really poisonous. No, kill you. Some iris variant.
No.
Wasn't it you that we were looking this up?
Yeah, but I remember.
Yeah, anyway. But some flowers can't be done that way. So the hardest one is like tuberose is really difficult to do distillations because the flavor breaks down. Now, we used to do tuberose in the rotovap. Remember, Stas? That was a pain in the behind. We would rotovap the tuberose because it was all at a low temperature, so it wouldn't break down. Do you like tuberose?
Mm-hmm. That's the one that grows on the beach?
No, it's the one that they make Hawaiian leis out of, and it's got that like aroma. It's hard to do. Anyway. The classic way to do flowers that are difficult to do via distillation is a technique that Sam Mason used to play around a little bit with, but it kind of got superseded by fat washing in general, but is enfleurage. And so remember, was that movie, Stas, about the perfume guy with the enfleurage where he was like...
Eric says perfume, yeah.
Yeah? It was just called perfume? What was he doing? Killing people and getting their aromas? What was he doing?
Yeah, that was it, yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, the way enfleurage works is that it's labor-intensive, is that you take the aromatics in the flowers are soluble in fat. So what they do is they take a solid fat, spread it on glass plates, and then put the flowers onto the glass plates, and then stack the glass plates up so that the aromas are just constantly wafting in these crates of glass plates through the fat. And then, like, after a specific amount of time, like a while, they'll rip the old flowers off, slap slap another layer of flowers onto them and basically get these like hyper aromatic flower fat things. And the reason you leave in there for a long time is that the flowers, you pick the calyx off, by the way, the green part, so it's doesn't have those green things, aromas. The flower keeps on making aromas until it starts to break down. And so the flower, like the, rather than just getting like a couple of minutes or a couple, you get like a long period of the flower producing these aromas that you absorb into the fat. Then you wash the fat with very high proof ethanol to take the flavors out of the fat. But you're not pulling any of the weird, bitter, crappy stuff out of the flowers because you've already removed the flowers from the equation by the time you put the alcohol in. And that that is how enfleurage works, and that's the way I would go.
And we gotta go.
Cooking issues.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Awali, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.